Good afternoon. I'll call to order the State Government Budget Division for February 11, 2009. We do have a quorum. Today, we've got the CAP Board, the Minnesota State Lottery, and the Racing Commission. So we'll start with the CAP Board. Ms. Stark and members of the CAP Board, welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Nancy Stark. I am Executive Secretary of the Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board.
My name is Paul Mandel, Principal Planner for the CAP Board.
Just before we get going, who are the CAP Board members from the Senate? Senator Pappas, are you still on the board?
Yeah.
And Senator Restis Shields?
Senator Restis.
So the two members who are on this budget division are on the CAP Board. Okay, thank you.
Yes, we are very fortunate. Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
The Capital Area Architectural and Planning Board was established by the 1967 legislature. It is a small, non-cabinet planning and regulatory agency responsible for architectural design and long-range planning for the capital area. The legislature sets the CAP Board boundary areas and the board's responsibilities.
There's a BlackBerry near a microphone somewhere. So, oops, there it is. Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead.
The board's responsibilities are found in Minnesota Statute 15B. The board's mission is twofold. First, to preserve and enhance the dignity, beauty, and architectural integrity of the capital and the capital area's unique historic character. And secondly, to help plan and guide the area's future development by maintaining a flexible framework for its physical growth. The CAP Board consists of 12 members, chaired by the Lieutenant Governor, and is composed of 4 gubernatorial, 3 mayoral, and 4 legislative appointees. And we've already identified the Senate appointees.
Who are the House members then? So.
The House members, we have a new member, Representative Diane Loeffler, and we also have Representative Maury Lanning.
Okay, good.
They were reappointed just recently.
Thank you.
3 architectural planning professionals advise the board. The staff serving the board consists of 4 employees, an administrative assistant, a fiscal officer, Paul as our principal planner and zoning administrator, and myself as executive secretary. The CAP Board has exclusive zoning jurisdiction and design review over both the state government complex and the surrounding commercial and residential neighborhoods. The agency guides this planning and design with a comprehensive plan and zoning and design rules for about a 60-block area around Minnesota's Capitol building. These 2 documents are in process of revision through funding that was provided in the 2007 session.
And Mr. Chair, members, you will be seeing action. We have we're about 2/3 of the way through right now with our rewrite of our zoning ordinance. 10 years ago, we had consultants work on our comprehensive plan and then did the zoning ordinance in-house. This year, we have a consultant working on our zoning ordinance because so much of technology and there have been so many changes with regards to zoning rules that we are doing a major rewrite on our zoning, and that will follow, of course, Administrative Procedures Act. It will be published in the State Register. We're working through the neighborhoods, Department of Administration, and other agencies on that. And we'll also be updating our comprehensive plan with the funds that were appropriated through the legislature.
Okay. Go ahead.
Funds that were also appropriated in 2007, the funding went to the Office of Enterprise Technology, and the initiative was for small agency IT functions. These funds have allowed the CAP Board to update its website and provide training for staff to maintain this site over time. The public and you folks will find that the site is very friendly, with board documents easily accessed, and also great links that we have established to other capital's restoration projects. The site is actually www.caapb.state.mn.us, and you will find that in the biennial report that we've left on your desk. The board has a responsibility to provide the legislature not only with a biennial budget, but biennial report, but also capital budget requests for the Capitol building. And it is also charged by statute for routing and design of the light rail transit project through the Capitol area.
And we, in that role, we have been monitoring and we've been involved in the LRT planning for the past 20 years. We have both we have controls over the route as well as the design and all the final details of the station planning, and there will be three stations in the Capitol area, one at Wright Street, one over what they call the East Capitol area, which would be directly in front of the Freeman office building that will also serve the Regents Hospital Complex and Gillette Hospital, and then one down on 10th Street in the median just south of the freeways.
Mr. Chairman.
Oh, Sarah Pappas.
Just in terms of the light rail line, and I know the train's probably already left the station, but there might still be some opportunity for changes. I think we might be being pretty short-sighted to block off the northern capital in terms of its future use for public space by putting the light rail there in a trench with no pedestrian access. So I wish that, I think when that happened, I was off the cap board for a period of time, and wish we'd had more discussion about that, because I think we on the cap board should be protecting public spaces around the Capitol, and we've really kind of cut off that opportunity by putting the light rail line there.
Mr. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, I can address that. The only access that has been at all impaired with the planning, it's trenches. At the north steps right outside here, the depression will be a matter of a few inches in depth. At one point, it was a drop of 4 feet as they cut off the hill. But in working with the design team and with Met Council planners, it basically starts just west of the steps here. And so right outside the north steps, it's about 12 inches in depression. So the only crossing that is impaired is the ad-grade crossing across the street, which has always been one of the more dangerous ones, which is why they have a semaphore, and they still, it's one of the largest number of accidents in the Capitol area. You will have the crossing at Martin Luther King, and you will have across the crossing on the Cedar Street Bridge, and we are working along with the Department of Administration on enhancements to, or to provide for enhanced tunnel crossings at mid-block and also out of Lot B, should that be developed in the future for a future state building. So the only impact will be the at-grade crossing here right in the mid-block, which is, of course, a dangerous one.
So we won't have that.
So you will not have
so
that.
Won't have
correct.
That.
Okay, Sarah Rust?
Well, I'm concerned about the public space, too. I'm concerned about the Capitol space. And I don't like the light rail going back down there because we're not going to be able to, because of the intransigence of the house, we're not going to be able to move our mechanical things outside into vaults before the light rail starts getting built, and then it will be prohibitively expensive to do that in terms of rehabbing, renovating the Capitol space. So I'm coming to a position of not supporting the light rail there at all because we're just being forced into a position that, at least from the general Senate position, is just untenable.
Mr. Chairman. Senator Rest, we should talk to Representative Houseman because she has an idea for an alternative route.
That has been brought up in the Capitol Restoration Working Group, and her idea is to have talk about ruining public space. Talks about having the light rail line go in front of the Capitol,
right.
Or what
but
I would call in front of
the
Capitol.
Well,
on
the
a slanted drive. Line, which would mean huge implications for our tunnel system. So, I don't think that's At first, it sounded like, you know, something that might be possible, but...
Well, Madam Chair, not in front, directly in front of the Capitol. It's the next drive over, the one where the buses go.
I know, but it's like an angle going over the south side of the Capitol, but it will interfere with the tunnel system, so the tunnel system would have to be totally rebuilt.
So not on the road itself? Angle over the grass?
No, not what I understood she was wanting.
Well, I don't know what she's going to do.
Ms. Mandel.
Mr. Chair, if I might, we're aware that there continues to be discussion as to other alternative routes, and our hope would be that we can move forward with the Capitol Building some bonding monies next year for the Capitol Building restoration work, at least in the, with regards to these vaults, so we can get them in. Construction only starts in 2010 and goes through 2014 when operations would be happening. So we do have a window that we could get everything coordinated, but any rerouting to the front of the Capitol not only impacts, as Senator Rest has said, the tunnel system, but it would be of serious threat to all the public members, the general public, and the pedestrians using the mall, because once it went to University Avenue, you cannot bring it from University to Cedar in without doing some serious trenching across directly across the Capitol grounds. And unlike the area where it's been compared to the area in front of that serves the Target Center or serves City Hall and the Government Center in Hennepin County in Minneapolis, downtown Minneapolis, it's one thing to be having a crowd waiting for the arriving train. It's another thing for the crowd to be at a rally facing away from a train when all of a sudden you've got these three-car vehicles coming behind you. And I know Department of Public Safety, Capitol Security, has expressed extreme concerns that any route crossing the Capitol grounds would be in front of the Capitol would be a very, very serious threat to the public.
Sarah Rust.
Addition. I mean, it sounds like that we have plenty of time because 2010 to 2014. However, one of the presentations we heard at the CAP board some time ago from the Met Council and the people involved in that is that the portion that is closest to the end point in St. Paul, where's that going to be? They decided that yet?
Union Station.
That part may get built in the earlier time rather than being in 2014. So they may start in this area.
Start at that end.
So the window is right. to get just the empty vaults even built so that the ground doesn't have to be disturbed again at an extreme cost. We don't have till 2014 to get that done. It's my understanding. Maybe they can correct it.
Randall and Mr.
Well, 2010 would be the funding deadline, so we can move forward with that. That's why next year becomes critical for the bonding bill for the Capitol Building.
And I mean, we can't stress. I mean, you folks already know it, but I mean, the pipes in the women's bathroom across the hall here burst a few weeks ago, and the doorway out here was, we had bricks falling down and so forth. I mean, and that doesn't even talk about, we've been downstairs in the tunnels and so forth. I did meet recently with a new liaison from the governor's office, you know, who was the liaison to this budget division, and I'm not quite sure that they were quite up to speed on some of these issues, too, and they need to be, so. Okay.
Well, we can address those. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The CAP Board's operating budget is currently $373,000 per fiscal year. The Board's current base budget breaks down as follows. Approximately 83% of it is for salaries and benefits. Our rent is about 9% of our budget. Our land and IT charges are approximately 2%, and the remainder of 6% goes for our business operations. The governor is recommending a reduction of $38,000 over the biennium. This represents a 5% base reduction to the board's general fund budget. That being said, there are steps that we may need to take so that the agency's core activities will remain intact. Some of them are reduce our agency operating hours and staff time by the use of leave salary savings. I think you've perhaps heard it as LSS. These measures we undertook as an agency in the 2004-05 biennium, right, and again in 2006-07.
Then they're done it. Okay, right.
I think you remember that. Mm-hmm. We also may have to reduce the number of board and advisor meetings and the reviews by these people of our projects and our policy initiatives. We also may have to reduce new equipment funds and office systems maintenance and repair. This will limit updating of agency planning tools, district maps, mall maps, and the engineered documents that we subscribe to. And most of all, I think for us personally, it will eliminate any professional training and development. The CAP Board has always been proactive in achieving efficiencies of budget and shared services. The agency is located in a building with a cabinet agency, that being the Department of Administration, where savings are achieved between the two agencies by sharing of space, equipment, land, connections, IT support, and purchasing programs for computers. The CAP Board has always had budgeting assistance from the Financial Management and Reporting Division of Administration. For many years, we've been working with them, even prior to the creation of the SMART team. We continue that relationship today. In conclusion, staff and I will work to ensure the quality of CAP Board services provided to the public and to other state agencies, and we'll make sure that this quality is not reduced. However, the budget reduction proposed will most certainly slow the delivery of our services. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. We appreciate the opportunity and welcome your questions.
Yeah, just to be clear, it looks like about 83% of your budget goes to salary and benefits and then 9% to rent. So, I mean, that's – and so if the proposal is to reduce you by $19,000 for each of the next two fiscal years, basically salary is where it has to come out of, I would think. And you are dealing with some big issues. The Ford building, I would imagine we have to figure out – the long-range plan for that. You mentioned LRT. We've talked about the Capitol building itself. So the challenges are there. Any questions of the CAP Board here, members? Cyrus?
I've been asking about the recent financial audits for everyone who's come before us, and the most recent one I have is through June 30th of 2003. Have you been audited since then?
No, Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, we have not.
Okay, there were, Mr. Chair, there were three findings at that point with regard to payroll and expenditure reports that were to be properly recorded, to complying with the state's procurement, hard time saying that word, requirements, and recording transactions in the state's accounting system. Now, I know you're a small agency, obviously, but did you just say you were now in the SMART system, and are they doing the work for you, or are you doing your own stuff in terms of accounting, and have you resolved these findings?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, yes, we have. We are not part of the SMART system, although, as I have identified, we've had a very close working relationship with the Department of Administration and their FMR division. Yes, we have resolved those findings. I would point out that these findings involve no monetary discrepancies or failure to maintain a balanced agency budget. It was the recording. Right. It was in a couple of circumstances using the wrong object code. Mm-hmm. And so all of these, I would say, were or could be considered administrative.
And, Mr. Chairman, so those you're doing it correctly. with regard to those findings now?
Mr. Chair, send a rest, yes. We work very closely with admin's financial budget division.
It looks like you're on a four-year cycle for them, so the audit periods would start July 1 of 2003 and go through till 2007. Have they approached you for a new financial audit or internal controls audit?
Mr. Chair, send a rest. Yes, I was approached about a year ago this time and notified that they would be coming over the summer months to audit. In August, I was contacted again and said that we were of a lesser priority on their list. And I have not heard from them since.
We have kept them busy with other things.
And Mr. Chairman, that is a that's unfortunate because I think you learn things from audits, and to have a period where you're where it gets longer and longer in terms of the rotation ends up not being I don't think it ends up being helpful to you and certainly not to us. But thank you.
Yeah, Mr. Chuck, the purpose of the SMART program is to help very small agencies, you know, deal with human resources issues and some of the other things they may not have the expertise on. Is there a particular reason why you're not using some of those services?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think it's because we have always done our own billing, our own payroll. We are small enough that we have not hired any new employees. I do all the employee reviews. So from an HR standpoint, we keep current through news from the Department of Administration what initiatives or programs might be out there for updating our agency operations. But we've always felt that I have all of the officers within the company that are very capable of doing all of the expenditures as well as the HR functions that we need to do.
Okay. Any other questions of the CAP board? Well, thank you, and stay in touch. By the way, I know there's a legislative moratorium on doing it with the Ford building, but has the CAP board got any thoughts about long range, what we ought to be doing with that thing? It becomes a daily nightmare for admin, you know, with all the problems that's happening over in that building. So,
Mr. Chair, we were part with admin of the study that involved, I think, more than a dozen legislators, both senators and House members, back about 2 or 3 years ago. The neighborhood itself desperately wants to keep the building or to have some of that kind of presence because their fear is, should that building go away, you just got more parking lots, and the church, which is a very active church, loses that much more of the fabric of the neighborhood. From an urban design standpoint, our long-range plan, our comprehensive plan, sees that entire block as an infill block with taking the surface parking and putting it into structured parking, possibly saving the front of the building, which is the historical part. The building is stable. The problem is because of what it was designed for, a Ford assembly plant prior to when they went horizontal, the floor-to-ceiling relationship compared to what would be a new office building does not work out. But I think and also there are also questions as to its reuse because of the IRS tax rules. A private entity or a nonprofit cannot get involved and use more than 5% of the total square footage because bond dollars were used on that building. So it sort of becomes, if at best it would be a public-private partnership, but there doesn't seem to be an answer right now. I don't know whether the future LRT station might spark something. Certainly it's going to be prime real estate in the future, and it is connected to the tunnel system with a very viable tunnel. So it's a very usable parcel, but what its future is, I'm not sure.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Sarah Pappas.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Mandel If it was a former Ford assembly plant, how are bond dollars used?
Ms. Randall.
Mr. Chair, Senator Pappas, bond dollars, first of all, were used to acquire the building. There used to be attached to it a hotel, and that was demolished. And then over time, bond dollars were used, and I don't have the schedule of how often, to both maintain it and improve it, its elevators, et cetera.
Okay, so but to purchase it. From
to purchase it and maintain it, company. Right.
Okay.
Sir, we'll see.
Mr. Chair, thank you. You know, in transportation, we did so much to try to get going on the transportation building. Do you have any update on that? And if they're going to try to make the building a little more, you know, you guys work so hard to make things kind of fit in with the Capitol, and I think that 50s era just doesn't blend real good. But.
So it's ugly? Okay.
Couldn't agree more.
Mr. Chair, my understanding, I don't know for sure, but my understanding is that basically they're going to take all the granite pieces off the building, install the new hanger system, if you will. I think what you describe it, the anchoring system, and then reuse all the existing granite. I believe that's the latest plans we've heard. Not much you can do with it. I mean, over the space of like a decade, there was more than $48 million spent on the interior, and it is what it is. I mean, you're not going to make it look like anything but a 50s building, but
like to work on this.
Or just wait for the granite to fall off. That's what can happen, you know. So, jeez. Okay. Sarah, we'll see.
And then also with the lines, along the lines of the Sears building, I had heard, you know, that Sears was looking at closing a number of stores nationwide. I wonder if that's one, and if there's any ideas of looking at that as a future complex.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olsen, I have actually been in discussions with the folks from Sears, because as part of our coordinated planning work with the City of St. Paul, that for the Rice Street Station, they have what they call a station area plan effort, and they've looked at basically an infill of that entire parcel, both with the options of Sears remaining or Sears leaving. Sears has expressed their intention to stay. They're open to a new building where they would run their facility, but right now this is supposedly one of the most profitable Sears building, because it's all, everything's paid off and clear, and they're leasing, I believe, 700 spaces or 600 spaces to the state of Minnesota for parking. So the place looks busy too to its customers. But the city and our new zoning will allow for intensification of the land use on that property, including its all its parking and everything else going to structured parking and higher and better uses of the land. But my understanding is they fully intend to stay there.
Thank you. Any other questions? Well, thank you, and see you out there. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I don't know if members have ever taken the opportunity to learn about, you know, the Capitol area, but, you know, like this area here that we're in right now used to be obviously three different rooms. There's three different doors, and there's walls that used to be here where the pillars are. And this area used to be the when all the state government agencies were, and this was the Department of Military Affairs area. And there used to be a door right here, which actually is Ms. Lonergan's office on the other side right now. That's where their vault was, where they stored all their ammunition and stuff like that. And the general or whoever had the Department of Military Affairs had a door that was right there that was part of his office. Senator Dibble's office there. I mean, the door is still there. You open it up, and there's a wall there when you open the door up. But that used to lead into here. So it's kind of interesting when you find out what used to happen in this building here. So. Thank you very much. Okay, next we have, what is it, the state lottery. Welcome to the budget division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Yes. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Clint Harris. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota State Lottery. With me is Don Feeney, our research and planning director. I want to thank you for the opportunity to discuss our budget today. I'm going to discuss the context of what we do and how our budget is determined. And then I will turn it over to Mr. Feeney, who will discuss the budget in more detail. First, for those of you who may not be familiar with the Minnesota State Lottery as others, our mission is to offer fun, innovative games and to offer fun, innovative, and secure games that create excitement, reflect Minnesota values, and maximize contributions to the state. We sell two types of games, scratch tickets or instant tickets, and games such as Powerball that you win by matching numbers on a computer-generated ticket to numbers selected in a random drawing. We have no connection to charitable or lawful games such as pull tabs and raffles, racetracks, card rooms, or casinos. While on the surface this seems like a simple task, let me assure you that it is not. Technology involved with selling hundreds of millions of dollars worth of product through 3,000 retailers in itself is extremely challenging. On top of that, we must take every effort to ensure the security and integrity of our games. The public must have complete confidence that every player stands an equal chance of winning and that every dollar they spend is properly accounted for. Finally, we must operate in a very demanding and competitive marketplace. No retail store has to sell lottery tickets, and no customer has to buy them. The lottery is only one of many products that the customer can choose from, and we are constantly challenged to design and market products that the customers want to buy. Last year, we sold $462 million in lottery tickets. From this, we returned $116 million to state programs as determined by the Constitution and the legislature. As you probably know, the Constitution requires that 40% of the net lottery proceeds be dedicated to the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. With the remainder of our net proceeds going to the general fund. In addition, and in lieu of sales taxes divided between the general fund, the game and fish fund, and a natural resources fund. That distribution is determined by the legislature. Any prizes that are not claimed within 1 year are awarded to the general fund. Finally, the legislature appropriates lottery funds for the state's compulsive gambling program. The lottery does not receive an appropriation from the legislature. We pay our expenses out of the revenues from ticket sales. However, the legislature does set a limit on what those expenses can be. It's that limit that needs to be in this year's appropriation bill. Mr. Chairman, we try very hard to be responsible stewards of our operating budget and, in fact, of everything that constitutes lottery revenue. We review all expenditures carefully to ensure they either help generate revenue or guarantee the integrity of our games. While we have not been required to reduce our operating budget, we have redoubled our efforts to identify efforts where we can achieve significant cost savings. Most of these are not reflected in the budget before you, but will be reflected in the March revenue forecast. Mr. Feeney will discuss these efforts in greater detail. That being said, I will not hesitate to invest in new activities, technologies, or products when I believe the result will be additional revenue to the state. Mr. Chairman, I know you have asked that the focus of this presentation be on the budget. Those of you who would like more detail on our operations can find it in our 2009 overview, which is in your packets. I'd also like to invite any committee member or staff to visit our offices in Roseville to get a better sense of what we do and how we operate. And with that, I'll ask Mr. Feeney to present our 2010-2011 budget.
Thank you, Mr. Harris. Yeah, I've toured your facility, and I think we've had members from this budget division out there too. If you haven't,
state and local government,
and yeah, your committee. Yeah, it is an interesting operation, and you get to see all the computer operations and so forth, and some of the checks and systems that on the integrity of the system. I think one of the things that is on our minds, of course, is how has the downturn in the economy been affecting the lottery operations, and maybe this is what Mr. Feeney's going to get to, but obviously we're interested to see how it's coming into play here.
Mr. Chairman, right now we have not been really hit by it hard. We know it could happen because our sales since July 1st, which is the start of the current fiscal year, we're up 11% overall in sales. I think most of that was done by, you know, doing a better job of the research, determining what our players like and the types of games they like, and I think that's contributed to the reasons why we've done that.
Or people think they might beat the odds and somehow come out of this better set of rest.
But we know that from talking to the director of the Gambling Control Board and members of the charitable gambling industry and also just anecdotal reports from, well, we'll hear them, I guess. We could ask the Racing Commission folks that the, you know, stuff is down at the tracks, it's down in charitable gambling, and there's every indication that the people are not using discretionary funds at the casinos either. So gambling is having a downward turn, but not not the lottery.
Interesting. Mr. Feeney.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Don Feeney, Research and Planning Director, Minnesota State Lottery. You should have copy of some graphics that I'll be referring to in my presentation, and just so you can follow along. Director Harris mentioned that fiscal year 2008 was our best sales year ever, and what's I think particularly noteworthy on that is we had the third largest sales increase in the country. There are currently 42 states with lotteries, and in terms of percentage increase, 39 of them did worse than we did, which I think is rather extraordinary. We're also on target to meet our fiscal 09 budget. We're going to make the revenue targets that a year ago we said we would make, which, again, is also a situation that most lotteries around the country are not in. Overall, I've seen a figure that I think for the first 6 months of the fiscal year, U.S. lotteries on the average are down 2% in sales. Some of them are down considerably more than that. I know of our neighboring states, Wisconsin and Iowa, I know are down, I believe, in the single digits, but they are down. Colorado, which is one of the two states that had a bigger increase than we did in 08, just said that their sales are now down somewhere between $500,000 and $750,000 a week. And yet we're still maintaining an 11% increase for the first 6 months of the fiscal year. It's a rather extraordinary situation, which I think we don't know how completely to explain. I know that there is some substitution going on, that, as Senator Rest mentioned, other forms of gambling are down. And, in fact, I know charitable gambling by itself is down more than we are up, not to mention racing and card rooms and casinos. But and I think there, so you have people saying, well, maybe instead of going out to the casino for the evening, and I'll buy a few lottery tickets and go home and scratch those off instead, save some money. I think that's entirely possible. But those other states have casinos and other forms of gambling, too, and they haven't been able to take advantage of that substitution. I'm not entirely clear on why we've been able to and they haven't. I would like to think that it's because of a number of things that I feel that we are doing right. For example, we are much more active in promotions than virtually every other state in the country, and that's everything from special events at the Mall of America to working with our retailers and saying, all right, if you're going to have a fifth anniversary for the store, we'll be out there and we'll help you with some merchandise and, you know, buy five lottery tickets, get a T-shirt or buy 10 lottery tickets and you give a free car wash, that sort of thing. Related to that, we measure and evaluate everything. And that includes all of those little promotions at the store level, big promotions, introductions of new equipment or whatever. So we know of those promotional activities what works and what doesn't, and we can adjust accordingly. We can then, of course, also go up to our retailers and say, if you do this, if you do this kind of promotion with us, we know this will work for you in terms of sales and for us in terms of revenues. And I know that most lotteries are not quite that active in that. Mr. Harris mentioned that we have made great efforts to know our customers. And what they like. So we can do things, for example, like say, well, if we're going to be partnering with the Minnesota Twins on a promotion, we know what Minnesota Twins fans who play the lottery like to see in a lottery ticket, and we know what price we should offer that ticket at, we know what play style we should have on that ticket, and what types of prizes we should have on that ticket. So we're taking a lot less of a risk when we introduce a ticket like that, that it'll not sell because, oh, that prize level wasn't interesting to people who would normally be interested in a baseball ticket. This is the kind of thing that I think most consumer-oriented businesses do routinely, but most lotteries throughout the nation have not. I think we've done also, in general, a better job of marketing our products, certainly than we have in the past, but also than what I see from a number of the other lotteries nationwide. That being said, while we're succeeding where others are not succeeding as well is still, I think, somewhat guesswork on our part. Sales certainly are difficult to project because they depend on all sorts of things beyond our control. We've seen effects of gas prices. I suspect gas prices going down have helped lottery sales. But again, gas prices have gone down everywhere. The random nature of jackpots. If we had had Powerball jackpots like we would expect this year, we would have had sales and revenues considerably higher, in fact, than we're seeing now. Powerball jackpots have not been very high. We're hoping that will change. If you look at on our sales history, you'll see that big spike in fiscal year 06. That's because in fiscal year 06, we had two jackpots in excess of $300 million. That hasn't happened since then, and that was something of a statistical fluke. We can't depend on that, and so we try to put a lot of our marketing effort into games that have a steadier stream of revenue, and that's where we're seeing our growth. If you look at the return to the state, you see that fiscal 08 was our second highest year ever, behind fiscal 06 because of the Powerball jackpots, which are absolutely wonderful because that means we bring in lots of extra revenue with not much added expense. So that it's an extremely profitable thing. And we are on target to make the figure, the budget amount that we had projected for fiscal 09. You can see how our revenue is distributed. The single biggest item, of course, is prizes. That's a constant balancing act in terms of what we have to pay out in prizes. Because if we don't pay enough, people don't play. And if we play too much, that's money that's lost to the state. Obviously, we could pay out 100% in prizes. Lots of people would play, but we would make no money. And finding that sweet spot is constantly a challenge. Retailers earn about 6 cents on every dollar they sell. They earn a commission for selling the ticket. They also earn a commission for cashing in winning tickets because we believe that certainly there's a labor involved on their end, but that also leads to additional sales at the retailers and for us. Ticket expenses are about 3.3%. That is essentially the cost that changes with every ticket we sell. It's the cost of printing the scratch-off tickets. It's the cost of delivering those tickets to the retailers. And it's the cost of the systems that sell the online games like Powerball, Gopher 5, Hot Lotto, where we pay our vendor a percentage of sales on those. The more tickets we sell on those, the more that expense the more that expense is. And so those expenses are handled separately in the budget. We then have our administrative costs, which in fiscal 08 was 5.2% of the lottery dollar. And that is where you set the cap on operating expenses, and that includes all other aspects of our operation, and we'll get into that in a little more detail. And finally, last year, 25 cents out of every dollar that was spent on lottery tickets went back to the state for one of the beneficiaries. The contributions come in a few forms. It's net proceeds, which is basically what a business would call profit. 40% of that goes to the Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. That's dedicated in the state constitution through 2024. The remaining 60% goes to the general fund, although that is at legislative discretion. Unclaimed prizes, if someone doesn't have – people have 1 year to claim a prize. If they don't, that money comes back to us, and that in turn goes entirely to the general fund. That's kind of a difficult one for us to predict, and it's certainly one that we have very, very little control over. We know that if there's a big Powerball jackpot, we'll see a surge in unclaimed prizes because people say, oh, I didn't win the jackpot, and they don't look to see that they won $10, $3, or whatever. That's one thing that is extremely predictable. There is a 6.5% in lieu of sales tax on lottery tickets. That is distributed according to a formula that is determined by the legislature. Currently, 28% of that goes to the general fund and 36% each to the Game and Fish Fund and to the Natural Resources Fund. The Natural Resources Fund goes for state, metropolitan area, and local parks and trails, and another amount going to the state's three zoos.
Okay, sir, to rest.
You mentioned, Mr. Feeney, that the 60% that goes to the general fund is ours to do, just goes into the general fund. Have we ever dedicated any of that?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, initially,
Okay.
The Greater Minnesota Corporation, or something.
I'm sorry?
Wasn't it the Greater Minnesota Corporation?
Yes.
I'm trying to get that history in my
there
mind.
Was the Greater Minnesota Corporation. There were also two infrastructure funds in the that lasted less than 1 year, at which point in 1991 the state was faced with $1 billion deficit.
Was that
which sounded enormous at the time, and so that money was rededicated to the general fund. It's been there ever since.
What about the unclaimed prizes? Haven't there been fights over that over the years? Where that goes,
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest. I don't know if fights are the right word, but it's been it's gone to a few places.
In this climate, I would call them fights.
Okay, and initially, the unclaimed prizes went. came back to us, and we used those to supplement prizes for games. So we would have games, you know, we'd put a game out there that would have a 75%, 80% payout, and the sales and revenues on that were tremendous. And I still believe, actually, if we were able to take that money back and put it back into the prize pool, we could generate more money than just comes to the state in unclaimed prizes. That being said, I also recognize that the unclaimed prize money is a sure thing. Which counts for a lot at this time. There has been discussion as to whether the unclaimed prize money should be subject to the same 60-40 split that the net proceeds are. Currently, that does not happen. It all goes to the general fund.
I think the fights that Senator Rest was referring to around here, when people are looking for money, I mean, somebody remembers, oh, yes, there's some unclaimed, and they try to use that money for a particular program or something like that. That's what happens.
But the traditional fight is whether 40% of the dollars should go to the Environmental Trust Fund. And have we ever done that or just debated it?
Yeah, I think so. We did. 40% Trust Fund. Chair Senator Rest, or legal counsel Dan McDonald reminds me that yes, at 1.40% did go to the trust fund.
And did we change that with the 2003 budget deficit to have it all go to the general fund?
Mr. Chair, Senator, that's sounding familiar to me.
That's when it goes.
He's nodding yes.
So okay. It's not available to take for the general fund because it's already there.
Correct.
Right?
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
Correct.
Another
door closed.
Okay.
Okay, Mr. Feeney, go ahead.
Let's see. Where was I? Oh, I talked about the in lieu of sales tax. The legislature makes an appropriation from the Lottery Prize Fund to finance the Department of Human Services compulsive gambling program. That's generally done in the Human Services bill, not in the State Department's bill, although it has moved around from committee to committee in the past. That appropriation was $4.6 million for this current biennium, and the lottery is the sole source of funding for that program. We have to check every prize of $600 or more for debts owed to the state. That includes back taxes. It includes child support. It could theoretically include overdue library books, I suppose. But
what kind of results do you get on that? I mean, you know, do you get a lot of people that, you know, hit a jackpot and, you know, then you wind up then we hit the jackpot at our end? Or
Mr. Chairman, not nearly as much as we used to because word has gotten out.
Oh, okay.
About that, you know, the amount I looked it up. We've collected, I think, $2.5 million over our 17-year history. So not a tremendous amount. Occasionally, you know, we get a winner in who comes in with a $10,000 ticket, and we tell them, "Congratulations, sir! You've now paid off part of your debt to the state," and they're not happy. For the most part, I think people have figured out that, oh, I'll have a friend come in and cash the ticket if that's the case.
Oh, okay.
We
so
occasionally have some surprises,
okay.
But yeah. Gotcha. And then, of course, prizes are subject to state and federal income taxes.
Right.
We don't know exactly how much money that generates, but we know that last year we withheld $9 million on prizes for Minnesota. Tax certainly much more than that at the federal level. So it's a significant contribution to the state coffers there. You look at our operating expenses along with our projections for the biennium, and I mentioned what's included in those operating expenses. As Director Harris mentioned, we have not been asked to take a cut by the governor. However, when the magnitude of the fiscal situation became apparent to us with the November forecast, we did sit down and go through our operating budget, starting with fiscal 9, and review that item by item to see were there areas where we could make cuts on our own and make a, and which therefore translates into a contribution to the state budget. We were able to identify close to $2 million in cuts that we could make in our operating budget for fiscal 09 alone. That will be reflected in the March forecast. It is not reflected in the budget that you have before you. And we have also made some cuts of our own volition in our operating budget, proposed operating budget for fiscal 10 and fiscal 11. Again, that is not reflected in the budget you have here. It will be shown in the March forecast.
Generally, what kind of areas did you look at to find those kind of savings? I mean, if we're going to see it, but I mean, do you have any idea?
Mr. Chairman, everywhere. A lot of it had to do with, I mean, marketing is the single biggest part of our operation, and so that's where a lot of the money came from. Some was just postponing some things we decided that we could live for a while without. Some had to do with we had put some money aside for some potential opportunities for new products that didn't pan out. And that happens, that money just goes to the bottom line at the end of the year. We thought this time around it would be important to recognize that beforehand so that it could become part of the budgeting forecast. We are very confident that we could make those cuts and not impact revenue.
Okay. Listen, John Martin, do you have a question? Or, I thought I saw your hand up.
No.
Okay. Please proceed.
There have been some staff costs that we've saved just by not filling vacancies or delaying filling vacancies. We've made some cuts. We've been able to make some cuts in our office space costs, advertising and promotion. However, we will, if the opportunity presents itself to raise additional revenue for the state, we will, as Director Harris said, make those sorts of investments. For example, we're looking at new ways of dispensing scratch tickets. As I said, we measure everything. We evaluate everything. We do not, when a vendor comes to us and says, hey, we have these wonderful new dispensers, we say, bring them on in. We'll tell them, give us a few. And we will put those out in the store. And we will measure over a period of time how well those do. If they work, they'll say, give us a few more. We'll do a larger trial. And we will not actually spend any money on putting that sort of thing in until we are convinced that those are going to be successful at the retail level. We're looking now, for example, at flat screen televisions at that small that would be out at the retail counter and display various lottery marketing messages rotating through every several seconds, and which
Amber Alert.
Pardon me?
Amber Alert.
Yes, and also things like Amber Alert. We could quickly program those to do any kind of public service messages as well. We've been watching those now in some stores for about 39 weeks. And we've found that on an average, for our average store, that will lead to $200 a week in additional sales. That's going to pay for itself very quickly. That's the kind of investment we will very carefully make. But we don't do those on a whim. We evaluate all those very closely. We can't always predict 2 years in advance what those opportunities are going to be, which is why we do ask for some flexibility in our budget so we can take advantage of that type of opportunity. You notice our history on employees, on our FTEs, we certainly had layoffs in fiscal 03 and more layoffs in fiscal 04. Since then, we have actually had some slight reductions in our workforce through attrition, through evaluating each vacancy as it occurs, sometimes trying to live without that position for a while to see what the impact would be, or until we see someone about to collapse from overwork or whatever it happens to be. But again, we do look at this at this very, very carefully. Our operating cap was initially set at $27.4 million in fiscal 04. We are asking for $28.7 million in fiscal 11. That means over 8 years that capital have increased less than 5% or about half a percent a year. And we have to obviously operate below that level because we don't know what the penalty is for exceeding it, nor do we want to find out. And of course, any money that we don't spend does fall to the beneficiaries, which is after all what we are about. The operating budget that will be that you will see in the for the March forecast will be below those cap levels. However, we are asking that the cap remain at the initial requested level, again, so that if the opportunity presents itself to earn some additional revenue for the state, we can do so. An example, about this time last year, we were offered the opportunity to participate with other states in a lottery game involving the television show Deal or No Deal, which then was at the height of its popularity. It was an expensive proposition to undertake because we had to buy the rights to the name, rights to the show. We had Howie Mandel doing some advertising for us. And the exciting part was that the prizes included the opportunity to essentially be a contestant on the show. We're looking more and more at prizes that people can't buy, and that sort of thing is tremendously appealing. That game wound up costing us $1 million more than an average ticket at that price would cost to introduce. However, and again, we didn't know that this was coming. That ticket generated $2 million in additional revenue over what a ticket that price would normally produce. So that investment gave us $1 million in profit that we would not have otherwise seen. And that's the kind of opportunity that that we look for. You can see there how our operating items are broken down for the past year's budget and for the coming biennium. Our biggest expense is personnel, but unlike the cap board, it's not 80% of our budget, it's only 40% of our operating budget. Our salaries and benefits are determined through the same collective bargaining procedures that every other state agency is subject to. Advertising is one of the larger items. By law, we cannot spend more than 2.75% of our revenue on advertising. However, in practice, we spend considerably less than that. Last year, it was 1.7%. And I think we're at a good level on that. I think we're at a level where that supports our sales. I don't know that we would see a tremendously greater return if we were to increase that amount significantly. The promotional items make up probably the next biggest thing, rent, and all the other items that you would expect from a state agency. And I can go into those in more detail if you would like. And then on the next page, you will see how that money breaks out to revenues. The general fund, between all the sources, winds up being by far the largest beneficiary of the lottery, and then smaller amounts to the trust fund, the Game and Fish Fund, and the Natural Resources Trust Fund. I thought it was worthwhile to show you some of our history, basically our history for the last 5 years, to show how far we've come as an organization. Essentially, from fiscal 03 to fiscal 08, sales are up 31%. More importantly, our revenue to the state is up an amazing 47%. We did this while reducing our operating costs by one quarter and reducing our FTEs by 30%. I think that's a record that we're real proud of. We're going to do our best to maintain that level. Finally, I mentioned the March forecast. Bottom line is that we will show in the March forecast $1.8 million in additional revenue just for FY09 and $5.8 million in additional revenue for fiscal years 10 and 11 for the coming biennium. I know that that's a really small part of the problem that you have to contend with, but we'll do what we can. We've done that from careful examination of our expenses. We've gone to our suppliers and renegotiated contracts. Our major supplier by itself our renegotiating contract with them will result in, Dale, what was the amount for the biennium? About $2.5 million for the biennium just for that contract. And on top of that, which doesn't show right now on the bottom line, I mentioned those marketing monitors at the retail counters before. They are giving us a large number of those for free. So it's an excellent deal for the state all around. Mr. Chairman, with that, I think that concludes our remarks, and we'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was looking through the budget, and I noticed these vehicles around, that have the Minnesota State Lottery stuff on there, and I don't see anything in terms of fleet, or maybe you could tell me how big your fleet of vehicles is, and where would it show up under expenses? And
Mr. Chairman, Senator Jungbauer, I believe that's under the all other category. That's all our transportation costs. We have
30
field lottery marketing representatives who service retailers all over the state, and those vans are essentially their offices. They show up at one of our offices once about every 2 weeks or so. Otherwise, all of the supplies and so on that they need are found in those vans. We did have to replace a number of those this year. They were getting to the point where they had 150,000 miles on them. They have people driving around in northern Minnesota in the winter, and those was making us nervous, and we decided it's about time to buy some new ones. So we stretch them out as long as we can, but
you don't see, when we're looking at budget issues, we don't want to see the library get in a position where the security, you know, some of the checks that you've got are in any way compromised. I think we've seen that some other agencies where, you know, they get rid of the auditor functions and then all of a sudden, you know, the audit issues start multiplying. You're on good ground.
Yeah, I mean, I think we're in good shape. We actually get our standard financial audit done by a private accounting firm. We also have an occasional audit from the legislative auditor.
Right.
We also do what we call a SIS trust, which is a deep penetration into our systems to determine whether everything is in good shape, that all of the rules of our IT staff, they're following those rules, they're documenting everything. So, you know, that's something we've launched in the last 3 years, and I think it's been very effective in helping us keep the integrity of our games in shape.
You know, Mr. Harris, you mentioned how you're accessible, and I, you know, just from my own thoughts, I think maybe that's the reason why, you know, your business may be up as opposed to others. I mean, when the price of gas was going up, people may have had second thoughts about the number of trips they're going to make to the casinos. I mean, the people who go to the Legion bars or whatever, the pull tabs or wherever they are, I mean, that you got to kind of go out of your way, but man, when you go to buy gas or whatever, I mean, the lottery is still there. So I think the accessibility may be part of the answer to why, you know, you've got a steady growth as opposed to the others. I don't know. Senator Jungbauer, do you have anything else, sir?
I just wanted to say thank you for running your vehicles up to that kind of mileage. I have been following the committee's benefit our online auction for other state vehicles.
What are you doing?
We are selling our vehicles significantly under what they're going for in the general market for the mileage and things. We tend to sell our other state vehicles at lower mileages, and we're not recovering the amount of money we should be. In rough calculations, I think we'd be much better off to run them up to somewhere between 120,000 and 150,000 miles. We'd come out better as a state.
Wow. Senator Olsen, could you?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your operating expense items, it shows about $500,000 a year increase in salaries and benefits, and that's pretty much going on since 2008. Are your folks all subject to the same bargaining units as other state employees?
Chairman, Senator Olsen, yes.
Yeah.
It's basically following the we follow the same salary guidelines that the Department of Finance told every state agency to use.
And so we gave the 2.5 or whatever percent before everybody else got this. Sarah Olsen?
This is a question in regards to, there was a story in the on the news lately about a small business in St. Paul where his employees were stealing his lottery tickets. Now, according to this business owner, and I was wondering if you could verify this, he's liable for those tickets. Is that correct?
Sure. Yes. Technically, when a retailer reports that their tickets have been stolen, the normal process that has that happen is they'll, you know, either break into the store in the middle of the night and they'll take a couple packs of tickets, and usually we can find them because they're going to go the retailer will report to us that two packs of tickets have been stolen, and so we will put those in what we call a stolen status, those two packs. And these people will go around and try to claim them, and we'll be able to know when those stolen tickets is being attempted to claim it at the, you know. And so, the retailer has basically says, well, I can't pay it. There's something wrong. I'll have to contact the lottery, and then we can usually follow those people, and usually there are cameras as well. But the difficulty with this particular case, the mini-pack store, is the clerks at the store were stealing them and cashing them right there at the store. And the problem with that is we cannot determine the difference between the tickets that were stolen by these people or the good customers that come in. I mean, we would not want to cancel those tickets for people who had legitimately bought tickets there. And so that's why, unfortunately, we put it in the responsibility of the retailer's responsible to manage and inventory their tickets, so they know that on a weekly basis or even on a monthly basis they're supposed to be inventorying and making sure they are protecting those tickets and keeping them safe. And I think for some reason this particular retailer was not aware that these three clerks were just stealing tickets right and left. I thought I heard something about that they thought the cameras were broken, that were monitoring it. So that's the problem. If we were to just basically, we need them to get a police report and work with us, and we would work with them to determine what tickets were stolen. In this case, it was too difficult to do because it was going on over a number of months, and it was there was legitimate purchases mixed in with the criminal purchases.
Wow. Sir Olsey?
What was the outcome of that? Because they were saying in the news report that he may have to close his business. Was he?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Olson, I'm sorry.
Olsey.
We worked with the retailer to set up a payment system, because normally we go in and take the money each week. We take the money from every retailer each week. We ACH it out of their account and put it in our account. In this case, he didn't have enough money for that, and so we worked with them to set up a payment plan that he could pay off those debts over that period, and that's what he's doing right now. I think it's about $1,000 a week. Now, it could mean that he's taking money that would otherwise be paying for the Pepsi and the Coca-Cola. I'm not sure.
Other question, Senator Rust.
Well, going back to the audits, as you know, 5 years ago, the legislative auditor had a very critical report of some of the operations, and then you came on board in October of that year. And
yes.
Prior to that, by July, the lottery had issued a report addressing all of the concerns that had been raised. But then there was a financial audit from July 1 to 2004 to December 31st of 2005, and there were four findings. And the report was issued September 28th of 2006, and in that, in your response, some of the issues were to be resolved following the issuance of the report. And so I'm just asking, like I've asked others, have those audit findings, that response has been implemented? And additionally, you said that besides this, the occasional audit, the rotating audit that the legislative auditor would do, that you also get an audit from a private CPA firm. And I was wondering, in your latest one, which I would assume be based on your fiscal year,
yes.
Have you received that yet, and were there any findings?
Mr. Harris.
Which one was this? Which audit?
Well, the one from the legislative auditor was one, an 18-month period from July 1st of 2004. You came in October through December 31st of 2005. The report was issued in 2006, and one of the findings was about background checks that you hadn't done, and then and you said the implementation date of resolving that finding was in October of 2006, and then the second finding was that you did not always comply with state purchasing policies with regard to goods and services, the procurement, I guess the MAPS thing. and then that you did not always retain evidence to support management authorization for changes to employee pay rates. And then the fourth one was documenting monitoring of payroll transactions. And the implementation dates were, I mean, you agreed with all the findings,
right,
and that you were going to do it, and it says you were going to do it in 2006 after the report got issued. And so I'm just asking, like I've asked the others, have all those findings been resolved? And then in addition, in the I'm assuming it's a financial audit that you get done, the private audit, in the latest one that you received, did you, were there any findings?
Thank you. Mr. Harris.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Rest, the previous audit you were talking about, mm-hmm, that one, we have taken care of every issue that's in there and complying with the things that we were not quite complying to. And the most recent one, I don't believe there were any,
no findings.
Findings.
A clean audit.
Right. It was a clean audit.
Thank you.
Yep.
Okay. Anything further of the Lottery Commission? Well, thank you, Mr. Harris. We'll be looking forward to the information in the March budget forecast. So, thank you.
Thanks.
And then the last item we have is the Racing Commission, which has the regulation of the Canterbury Park in Shakopee and then the Running Acres Harness Track in Columbus. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the commission, or committee, I'm sorry.
Well, it's a budget division, so the finance committee. So, right. Go ahead.
I'm Dick Kruger, the executive director of the Racing Commission. I'm not going to go over my overview like I have in prior years. What I'd like to do is to just give you an overview of the experience of this last calendar year, 2008. Refer to some of the pages in the handout that you do have, and briefly discuss what we're looking at as far as 2009, and then I would like to go over some of the budget numbers, and I do have another handout.
Sure. Obviously, we are quite interested in the budget, Eric, and that's what we do here, so go ahead. Yeah.
Which will itemize the lines in the governor's agency overview page. Last year, Canterbury Park raced Sixty-seven live race days. That was one day less than they had raced in the previous year. Their total live handle was 13.8 million. Their simulcast handle was 45.9 million. This is on page 5 of the handout, where we've shown a history going all the way back to 1985. Their total handle was just under 60 million. 77% of that was on simulcasting, and it was 14% lower than the total handle for the previous year, 2007, which was less than their handle was for 2006. At Running Aces, who conducted their first year of racing this past summer, their live handle was 1.2 million for a 53-day meet. And their simulcast handle was 5.2 million for a total handle of 6.4 million. And at Running Aces, 84% of their total handle was on simulcasting. As I mentioned, last summer was the first year of racing at Running Aces. They did open their card club right after the evening, after their 50th day of racing. There's a requirement in the statute that a new licensee at complete their at least 50 days of racing before they can open up their card club. So they did, the card club was open for 265 days last year. And then also the 2008 legislature did remove a restriction in the statute regarding all breed simulcasting at the two racetracks in the Seven County metro area. So at the end of April, the both racetracks did begin simulcasting breeds they weren't racing live. Canterbury was allowed to continue simulcasting standardbreds and Running Aces was allowed to simulcast thoroughbred and quarter horse races. And just for your information, Canterbury patrons bet $13,186 on Running Aces races, and the Running Aces patrons bet $252,388 on Canterbury's races. You know, I'm curious as to that holding up, and whether that $250,000 would have been bet at Canterbury had they had to drive down to Shakopee. We had the required staff on the grounds at both racetracks, three stewards at each racetrack who have fairly significant authority from the legislature as far as conducting hearings and penalizing individuals for violation of statute or rules. We had regulatory veterinarians on the grounds at both racetracks. They do all the pre-race exams at both racetracks. They supervise the detention barn or the test barn where we draw. We get urine samples and draw blood. We have investigators at both racetracks for both racing and the card club who interface on a daily basis with the stewards, the veterinarians, and the security and surveillance staff at both racetracks. And we have licensing staff at both racetracks and our contracted drug testing lab, industrial lab in Denver, Colorado, perform the testing for us for both the racetracks. Before leaving 2008, I do want to dwell for a moment on an appropriation that you did make to us last year. You appropriated to us for the biennium $359,000 for information technology upgrades, of which $295,000 was for 2008, and we spent about $211,000 of that money. We hired a project manager who came in and has done an excellent job. With that money, and this was a result of Senator Rest, that 2005 performance evaluation report by the legislative auditor, where we were criticized for being a little bit behind on our technology capabilities. But with that money, we did upgrade the licensing system. Even without Running Aces, we needed to upgrade that system. But in doing it, we then connected. We set the same system up at Running Aces, including the live scan for fingerprinting. And then we connected the two systems so that we can go in on either racetrack and see who we've got out there as being licensed. And we web-enabled the license application so that individuals, when they come in to get licensed or renew their license, can now do it electronically rather than the old paper form. And we are still in the process of identifying enhancements to that system. We've upgraded our parimutuel auditing system. We've eliminated some of the manual data entry that had to be done for that system. The main purpose of doing it is that every day we get a parimutuel tax payment from each of the racetracks for the Breeders' Fund. And what we want to ensure is that the tax is credited to the correct account, whether if it's a thoroughbred race, it goes to the Thoroughbred Breeders' Fund. Quarter horse or standardbred race, it goes to the appropriate Breeders' Fund in the Special Revenue Fund. Part of the upgrade of the parimutuel system is then interfacing it with the Breeders' Fund tracking system so that those payments that are made are accurately calculated before we make those payments to the state's horsemen and women. Of the $211,000, we did spend about $55,000 for hardware. That was new servers, workstations, not as a result of the upgrades, but just workstations for the employees at the new racetrack. And then one of the things that we did outside of the information technology improvements was involve this individual in some of our regulatory work. We've been able to focus time now on what we call tote testing and best practices, where we've gone in and audited the tote procedures of both the racetracks, tote security, used equipment storage, and things like that, and have made some recommendations to both racetracks. We are moving into a issue that is a focus of all of my colleagues across the country, as well as the Association of Racing Commissioners International, of which we are a member, and that's wagering integrity, which is currently a national focus, as I mentioned. And there we're talking about real-time monitoring of the betting as it is going on, the production of transactional detail reports and analysis, and a system that will give us alerts and reports on what we might think would be unusual betting going on. Now, we've just begun this. We had a presentation by one of the advanced monitoring services, they're called, made a presentation to our commission earlier this month. So we're just now starting to get into that, and it's going to carry in through the rest of this year and into the 10 and 11 biennium. For 2009, the commission assigned race days during its December commission meeting. Canterbury has been approved for 62 days of racing and Running Aces for 51, and they're both going to begin racing on Friday, May 15th this year. Both of them will be conducting year-round simulcasting, and the card rooms will be open 24/7. And again, we'll have the same staff on the grounds, which would be stewards and our veterinarians and our investigators. Before going over any of the detailed numbers, I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Well, as you get into that, Mr. Kruger, it looks to me, you know, just from the handles, I've seen the club card rake and the racing track handles, it looks like about three years ago or so, things seem to have peaked and have been steadily declining since. I take it that's probably a sign of the economy or something. Is that what are you seeing as far as the what's happening at the racetracks?
Mr. Chairman, I think it's a combination of things. Internet gambling has affected the racing handle, not just people are not going out to Canterbury to bet the races. They're doing it on the Internet, which in my opinion is illegal. They're also going on the Internet to play poker. They're also going on the Internet in sports betting. So I think all of that has had an impact on Canterbury since 2004, 2005. Most recently, though, it's the economy. I can't give you any hard information, but just the disposable income that individuals have now, it's in my mind, is affecting the attendance and the play that that Canterbury is getting. That's also reflected in the on page 7, mm-hmm. where we've detailed the total rake. You can see that has been declining over the last 3 years. And when that goes down, everything goes down. Canterbury's revenue to operate the card club, the set aside for purses, the money they pay to us out of that purse set aside for purse supplements, which supplements the purses for Minnesota bred horses. So that's just my opinion, Mr. Chairman. I should point out at this time that does not directly affect the revenues that we get that you appropriate. Our revenues are off the license fees that are charged to racetracks, which was changed during the 2003 session, and the governor recommended that we be funded out of dedicated receipts. So the Class A license fee is $253,000 each year for both racetracks. That stays the same. Canterbury is going to race five fewer days and the legislature has set a $500 fee for each live race day. So that's going to affect our revenues by $2,500. The revenues that are in this budget to cover the base level of $899,000 is $814,000. We're going to fund the $899,000 by carrying forward money from this biennium into the next biennium, each year the next biennium. It's when we get to the end of the next biennium that it'll be interesting when I'm sitting here in front of you, or perhaps at that time someone else might be sitting here in front of you.
Sir Babbitt.
So that's just...
Sir Babbitt.
Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt your sentence. Mr. Chairman, I think carry forward does require legislative authority.
Pardon me?
To carry forward from a one biennium.
Yeah. Do you have an authority to do that, or is right now the carry forward? Or is that some? Do you need legislative authority, or do you already have that? Or?
Well, the money we receive goes into the racing control accounts, and if the money's appropriated at that level by the legislature,
right.
We work with the Department of Finance to roll that money forward and then transfer it to our operating accounts.
Chairman, my only point is that I don't know if there are different rules for special revenue funds, but typically you can't carry forward money from one biennium to the next without authority. Sometimes you can't even carry it over from one year to the next. So I think you should look into that.
Yep.
Okay.
I think Mr. Lundeen can explain where it is here.
The expert.
Yeah, Mr. Lundeen.
Yeah, I mean, the dollars that the Racing Commission is spending is dedicated special revenue. It's not general fund dollars. So we appropriate up to a level, which is basically a spending cap. Mm-hmm. And as long as there's money within the account, and it will roll forward from fiscal year to fiscal year if it's unspent. And so then they will spend those dollars.
Okay. Sir Alcine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last year it seemed like Running Aces opened up. You know, it was almost snowing on the ground, and they opened up. Was that so they could get their race in, so they could start doing the simulcast?
I think so.
Mr. Krueger.
Mr. Chairman, Senator.
The Card Club, yeah.
I have Miss Manny here. She's our deputy director. She's actually officed up there, so she has her fingers on this a lot better than I do. But the answer to your question is yes. They wanted to get their 50 days in so they could open up the Card Club earlier, you know, which provided additional purse money and purse supplement money, which will be there when they start racing this year. But you're right, the weather was terrible on Friday night, April 11th, when they opened it. It was terrible.
Yes. Yeah,
but I do have a bigger concern, is that the developer, they went bankrupt, didn't they?
Well, there's been a change. Yeah,
not exactly. No,
I don't. But there was a change there. What happened there, Mr. Krueger? They're different owners now than we had. Or maybe we can get the person who's on the ground to tell us what the situation is there. Welcome to the Budget Division. Please identify yourself for the record. So,
I'm Mary Manny. I'm the Deputy Director of the Commission.
You want to go?
Yep, go ahead.
About a year ago, there were two partners, the holder of the Class A license and the Class B license is North Metro Harness Initiative. There were two partners involved in that licensee. Mountaineer Gaming out of West Virginia, who has the racing experience. They also own Mountaineer Park, Scioto Downs in Ohio, and a new track in Pennsylvania, Presque Isles Down, that just opened last year. The other 50% owner was Southwest Casino and Hotel Corporation, which is a Minnesota corporation located over by the Mall of America. Southwest Casino, a year ago, took out a loan to finance their pre-opening and opening to capitalize those costs from Black Diamond Commercial Finance out of Connecticut. Excuse me. One of the covenants in the loan was that if they missed an interest payment, Black Diamond could assume the equity that they had in the racetrack. They missed their July interest payment and exercised that option to take over their 50% equity ownership. Now, we did a background investigation on Black Diamond. At the time, they were coming in as the lender. Even though we didn't have the authority to do it, the commission said we're going to do it, and so we did do a background investigation of Black Diamond. So I hope that answers the
question. Well, it raises a lot of questions for me because this is a highly regulated enterprise racing in Minnesota, and it seems like they built their finance plan on a deck of cards. They had to know that, you know, the racing season, they wouldn't be getting the revenues they anticipated, you know, until they opened the card stuff. And so I'm just kind of surprised. And then did Southwest Casino, I mean, how could they sign? That's, I mean, it's just not good business for one thing, but they miss a payment and they lose their equity. What happened to them after losing all that investment in it?
If you know, Mr. Gruger.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if I can answer that, Senator. I know that their projections for their live handle, their average daily handle was 111,000. The average daily handle came in at 23,400. So they missed their projections by 80%.
Quite a bit.
Yeah. So that's a, you know, that's a cash flow problem right there.
And opening the card club, I think, helped, but didn't quite resolve all those problems.
That's correct. Yeah. Mr. Chairman, if you recall, they did have some legislation in here last year to allow them to open the card club after the commission had assigned their race days. But that legislation did not pass. But that would have helped.
Senator Rest.
Mr. Kruger, on your audit ending June 30th, and I think you referenced the Breeders' Fund, but there had been an issue that had was raised about whether the funds in the Breeders' Fund were they being distributed that were received from the card club, if they were being distributed correctly, and there were like two different interpretations going forward according to the finding, and the recommendation was simply that the Racing Commission seek legislation to clarify allowable uses of the Breeders' Fund monies received from the card club. Did you all act further on that? Do you know?
Mr. Kruger?
Madam Chair, Senator Rest, what report was that in?
This is
in Legislative Auditor's Report.
Your Legislative Audit Report from June 1st, 2001 through June 30th, 2005, issued on September 22nd, 2005. There was only one finding, and in the prior report, there hadn't been any, so it's a pretty good record, but that you had used two different interpretations of law to distribute Breeders' Fund monies received from the Canterbury Park Card Club.
Mr. Kruger.
Madam Chair, I'm trying to recall. I believe after the Card Club legislation. After the Card Club legislation.
The page, please.
The Card Club legislation passed in 1999. The Card Club opened in 2000. I recall that when we started to receive that money, we were depositing it for all of the categories in the Breeders' Fund: Breeders' Awards, Stallion Awards, and Purse Supplements. And I believe it was Representative Oskop, who was the chief author of the Card Club bill, said that money was supposed to have been just to supplement purses for Minnesota bred horses running in restricted races, just for minutes, so that the money would, you know, encourage people to, you know, breed horses and race horses. So I believe, and then we did that. All the money now from the Card Club is going into purse supplements. But I did not come back to the legislature itself and ask for clarification.
And ask for the clarification. Okay. Mr. Chairman, you might want to just review the letter from you on the last page with regard to that. You did respond to the audit.
Mr. Kruger, you said you had some other things you wanted to cover. Did you get everything in here, or did you still want to go through anything further here today?
Go through the budget stuff.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman.
Did you have something further you wanted? I think you said you had something else you wanted to cover here. Did you have anything else you wanted us to call to our attention?
I was just wanted to direct your attention to some of the budget
sure.
pages.
Okay, please do. Yes, we are interested in that.
The cover sheet is the governor's agency overview. If you look at page one, that details how we allocated the appropriation. You made a lump sum appropriation, but we tried to set up some control accounts for each racetrack so that, for instance, if we were to be spending less money at one than we are at the other, and there has to be a fee change, either up or down, we wouldn't hit them both, but we just go after the one. And then it also shows you how we distributed the appropriation rider for the IT development. If you go to page 3, where we have statutory appropriations, that details the money that we spend out of the Minnesota Breeders Fund, which is set in 240-18. That section starts out after the commission deducts its administrative costs. The rest of it then goes for equine research and all the Breeders Award programs. So with $30,000 to $33,000, we're administering a $1.1 million program. But then you can see roughly $30,000 goes for equine research. And I'm sorry. I'm looking at the wrong page here. The Running Aces reimbursement account and the Canterbury reimbursement account are $241.55, where you've given us authority to recover our costs for our contract employees of stewards, veterinarians, and our drug testing laboratory, and the costs, including personnel costs, of overseeing the card club operations. The other one I was just talking about is on page 4, where we got miscellaneous agency, the 610 fund, where you can see how that money that's in the Breeders Fund, 240-18, gets distributed back to the industry by breed, quarter horse, standard bred, and thoroughbred.
Okay. Is that anything further? Senator Roebling.
Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, the new partner at the Running Aces track, it sounds like they probably were in the casino business. Have they run any racetrack operations in the past?
Mr. Kruger or Ms. Manning, did you know? Okay, go ahead. Did the new partner at Running Aces have any running any racetracks in the past?
Mr. Chair, Senator Roebling, they have. They are the lender who took over the 50% ownership. They have done that in previous cases where they have had a casino or a gaming operation that has failed in their payments in lending and have taken over and taken an equity ownership in it, and they have then managed it to the point of either resell or they have stayed in it. But as far as day-to-day operations of managing a casino, they have little, but they have so far, and this is just my opinion in being there on a day-to-day basis, done a very good job since July and coming in.
Oh, Senator Rust.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's my understanding, too, Senator Roebling, Ms. Manning, that there was some provision in the between Southwest and Black Diamond that if things could get turned around, that they would be able to buy back their equity interest. So that's I think that, or at least I was understood that was part of the provision if things could get turned around. Is that
Mr. Chair, yes. Senator Russ, that is correct. Southwest Casinos does have the option until July of 2009 to purchase back their 50%.
Do we have any idea whether that looks likely or not? We just don't know.
We don't know.
Gotcha.
I have had no contact with Southwest since this.
What's your sense? I mean, is Running Aces getting into trouble? I mean, is it going to be viable in the long run, or is it too early to tell?
Mr. Chair, again, this is my opinion from what I've seen in the way things have been managed since the 50% takeover. It has been managed very well. Okay. The business is increasing on a daily basis, which is, you know, kind of unusual for this time of year to have the increase in the card club and simulcasting, but it has happened. They had their largest drop last weekend as far as in the card room. And I'm very pleased in what I see. They've been making cuts where they have to. Unfortunately, they've had to have some layoffs. They have had some recalls back on those employees. But they seem to be, you know, doing what has needed to be done from the beginning. So.
And any issues on the horizon for Canterbury? Anything that, I mean, how are they looking for? I mean, they've obviously been around much longer. They're more established. But should we have any concerns or issues there?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I know that last fall they did go through a series of layoffs. They laid off about 10% of their staff because their revenues are down. I'm not aware of any that have occurred in the last several months. I know they have cut back on their staff.
Okay.
You know, it's going to depend on how this summer goes as far as the attendance they get and the wagering that they get. The racetrack is owned by Minnesota Horsemen. I believe in my mind that they're committed to keeping that racetrack open. I don't know if any of you have had any discussions with them, but that's the impression that I have. They want to keep it going. They've just entered into some contracts with a information technology company that's 5 years of duration. So, and they renewed their contract with their totalizator system for another 5 years. So it, the impression that I have is that they're in it at least for that length of time.
Okay. Senator Rust.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, just a response to, again, Senator Roebling's inquiry. The Senator Lurie, who is the chair of the gambling subcommittee in the policy committee, stopped by Running Aces 3 or 4 weeks ago and found the card club very full, and I don't know when, you know, there in the afternoon or something, but full and very active and so forth, and hardly anybody doing betting on the simulcasting, which was available at the time. So the card club seemed to be remain quite attractive to, you know, for the recreational entertainment value that they provide for people who like to do that.
Okay, any other questions for the Racing Commission? If not, Ms. Manning, Mr. Kruger, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And members, next Monday we're going to be taking a look at the Gambling Control Board and the Amateur Sports Commission. So with that, thank you very much. See you next week.